Good afternoon, and welcome to the Green Thumb Show. I'm Lee Murray, your reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining us. From USA Today, how to compost, a guide for the novice or pro as spring growing season begins, by Miranda McGrath. Spring is here, and with it comes lawn care and perhaps thoughts of planting a garden. One of the ways to reduce household waste and help to create a nutrient-rich soil for those gardens, lawns, and landscaping is to compost. By following a few key steps, anyone can turn organic scraps into a valuable resource. Here's a guide to composting based off of Compost 101 by Steve Tharp Jr., Assistant Executive Director at Stark Tuscarawas Wayne Recycling District. First, how to begin composting and how to avoid the smell. To start composting, choose a location for a pile or use a bin with drainage holes. Start with a base layer of coarse material, such as straw or small branches, to add airflow and drainage. From there, build the pile using a mix of green and brown materials. Greens are those nitrogen-rich materials, including fruit and vegetable scraps, coffee grounds, grass clippings, and plant trimmings. Browns are those carbon-rich materials, including dried leaves, cardboard, sawdust, and wood chips. Maintain a ratio of one part greens to three parts browns. The balance ensures proper decomposition and prevents unpleasant odors. Second, the right mix of moisture and oxygen. A compost pile should remain moist but not saturated. The ideal moisture level is comparable to a wrung-out sponge. Rainwater may naturally hydrate outdoor piles, but in dry conditions, adding water periodically may be necessary. Aeration also is crucial. Turning the pile at least once a week allows oxygen to reach microorganisms that break down organic matter. Turn the pile with a pitchfork, compost tumbler, or by rolling a sealed bin on the ground. Third, maintaining compost. Regular maintenance is simple. Continue adding kitchen scraps and yard waste, always topping greens with three times as many browns to maintain the balance. Stirring the compost weekly helps accelerate decomposition and reduces odor. Adding a small amount of garden soil or aged compost early in the process introduces beneficial microorganisms, speeding up decomposition. Shredding or cutting materials into small pieces can help break them down faster. Fourth, fixing common issues: dry, wet, slow decomposition. For dry compost, add water or green materials to restore moisture. Wet or smelly compost, mix in additional browns such as cardboard or straw and improve aeration by stirring more frequently. Slow decomposition. Increase the amount of greens or add an activator such as garden soil or aged compost to introduce more microorganisms. Rodent or insect problems. Avoid adding meat, dairy, or oily foods and always cover food scraps with a layer of browns. And number five, using finished compost. In Northeast Ohio, composting typically takes about 6 months. Finished compost will be dark brown, crumbly, and have an earthy scent. It can be used to enrich garden soil, fertilize potted plants, improve lawn health, and even as mulch. For gardens, mix one part compost with two parts soil for planting. For lawns, spread compost lightly over the grass and rake it in to improve soil health. Composting not only reduces waste, but also promotes sustainable gardening practices. Also from USA Today, what is the best mulch? Depends where you live. Here are four options by region, by Paul Capello. What does mulch do for the garden and the gardener? Like anything, it's always best to know why you're doing something before you decide how to do it. Without knowing why you're mulching, it's hard to know how to properly mulch. Effective mulch can be just about any loose aggregate material that will stay where it's put, not significantly reduce air exchange into and out of the soil, and not contribute anything toxic to the soil or root environment. A proper mulch material can help to reduce evaporative water loss and reduce heat buildup in the soil during long, hot summers. It can help improve rain percolation into the soil, decrease weed pressure in the garden, and some mulches can also add nutrients to the soil below. Of course, that is assuming you've selected the right mulch for your location and you've applied it in a sensible way. So let's go to the brackets to see what works where. Northeast regional bracket. In this part of the country, the most common mulch material is probably hardwood bark. Most of it is a byproduct of the timber, lumber, paper industries. It is generally ground to a relatively uniform particle size and spreads fairly easily with a rake or mulch fork. One of the most interesting things to consider when looking to use hardwood bark mulch is whether or not your source is composted hardwood bark. Uncomposted hardwood bark has a tendency to form an impenetrable crust when it gets hot and dry in summer, meaning that summer thunderstorm or your irrigation attempt will send all that water sheeting off the mulch and down the storm drain while your plants suffer from drought conditions. Composted bark also supplies more net nutrient gain to the soil below and holds in place better during a heavy rain event. Basically, composted hardwood bark is a swish. Uncomposted bark is a brick off the back of the iron. Southeast Regional Bracket. Here, there are two winners. Pine straw is generally harvested from agroforestry operations where the needles are simply collected as they naturally fall from the branches. It is lightweight, easy to spread, and it holds in place quite nicely. Pine straw allows rain irrigation to pass freely into the soil and provides for excellent air drainage or exchange between above and below the mulched layer. Pine straw also has an added advantage of discouraging slugs, a major plus if you have any hostas in your garden. The biggest challenge with pine straw is that it is difficult to keep clean. If you have big old hollies that drop old yellowed leaves in early summer, a normal thing for hollies, those big long pine needles love to intertwine themselves among the holly spines. Trying to rake the leaves out of the mulch can be more infuriating than a lack of 3-second calls in a Big Ten game. The second winner in the Southeast region is what we call pine fines. This used to be a waste product from the manufacture of those giant, silly pine nuggets you sometimes still see for sale as mulch. Those giant nuggets provide almost no mulch benefit. They float away on the slightest bit of rain runoff. As kids, we used to file them into boat shapes and race them down the neighborhood creek. They provide almost no weed suppression, and they break down so slowly that they add little organic matter or nutrition to the soil. Pine fines, on the other hand, have particles less than 1/2 inch across. The product spreads nicely, looks fabulous, breaks down at a reasonable rate, and adds a nice bit of organic matter and nutrition to the soil. At UDell Botanical Gardens, we use it as both a mulch and as a soil amendment. The only foul call on pine fines as a mulch is that it is not a great product for a garden bed that sits on any kind of slope. A heavy Kentucky rain can send your pine fines down the driveway and into the street. For moderate to steep slopes, pine straw works better. Northwest Regional Bracket. I'm guessing that if you decided to take a walk around Gonzaga's college campus, you'd see quite a bit of what we call softwood bark mulch. Mostly consisting of processed bark from hemlock and Douglas fir, this mulch is similar to the Southeast pine fines, just maybe not quite as small in particle size. As with hardwood bark mulch, it's best to find a source that is composted, and if formal composting isn't an option, an old pile that's been sitting around a while is still better than fresh. The larger and sometimes stringier texture compared to pine fines means the Northwest softwood bark mulch will hold up a little better on a moderate slope. Finally, the Southwest Regional Bracket. Rounding out the geographic mulch brackets, we'll cover an inorganic mulch, stone. While stone mulches are not the only types used in the drier portions of the Southwest, they are more common there than in other parts of the lower 48. One reason stone mulches work well in the Southwest, and they work perfectly well in other parts of the country as well, is that the extreme heat of this part of the country would cause most organic mulches to break down to nothing in about the length of time required for a halftime score update. A good quality stone mulch will even last longer than the time it takes to review a foul call on a last-second game-ending three-pointer. Finally, regardless of your mulch of choice, please no mulch volcanoes around the base of trees and no more than 2 inches of mulch on any bed. Either one earns an immediate, flagrant one foul call. Also from USA Today, want to attract more butterflies to your garden? These plants are perfect for pollinators. The plants you choose and their location in your yard can make all the difference in creating a successful pollinator garden. Here are some tips to get you started this spring by Marianne Muhammad. Spring has just begun, and if you have a green thumb, you might be looking forward to your yearly gardening activities. As temperatures get warmer and the skies get sunnier, many critters will be out to enjoy the spring weather. That includes butterflies spreading their lovely, colorful wings and making their way to their favorite flowers. Wouldn't it be awesome to bring them to your garden? Here's how to build your own butterfly-friendly pollinator garden. What can butterflies do for your garden? Butterflies might be pleasing to the eyes, but they also make great pollinators for your garden. Just like bees, butterflies seek nectar from flowers, spreading pollen in areas where it's needed for plants to grow, according to National Geographic Kids. Planting flowers butterflies love can be a great benefit to not only your garden, but the environment. Most butterflies are active from spring to late summer when plant growth is at its peak, according to Masterclass. Now here are some tips for a flourishing butterfly-friendly pollinator garden. It doesn't matter how big or small you plan to make your butterfly garden, any size will do. Here are some tips for creating a successful pollinator paradise. Make sure your garden is in an area that will get at least 6 hours of direct sunlight each day. Butterflies need protection from rain and wind. Make sure your garden is near trees and shrubs. Be sure to choose both nectar plants and host plants for egg laying. Collect homemade bait such as scraps of rotting fruit. Make a water source to provide hydration for butterflies using a water dish, bucket, or lid. Avoid chemical-based pesticides as they may harm or kill pollinators. Make a butterfly shelter as a resting area for butterflies and caterpillars that need to cocoon. What flowers should you use for your butterfly garden? Choosing a diverse array of flowers is super important, according to the Ohio State University Extension. For your garden to blossom with your fluttering butterfly friends, you will need both nectar plants and host plants. Here are a couple of plant ideas to get your butterfly brain flowing. Milkweed, a butterfly favorite. Butterfly weed, purple coneflower, marigolds, black-eyed Susans, mustards, mints, and blazing star. So what butterflies are common in gardens? Certain butterflies are attracted to certain plants, and you may find that different kinds of butterflies live in your area. Take time to check out which butterfly species are common where you live and plan your butterfly garden accordingly. Here are 20 common butterfly species in the Midwest. Spicebush swallowtail, eastern black swallowtail, eastern tiger swallowtail, cabbage white, checkered white, clouded sulfur, orange sulfur, eastern tailed blue, spring azure, great spangled fritillary, pearl crescent, question mark butterfly, comma butterfly, morning cloak, red admiral, painted lady, red spotted purple, viceroy, monarch, and silver-spotted skipper. From the Arizona Republic, wildflower forecast. How big will this year's blooms be? Wildflower season 2025 is just getting underway in Metro Phoenix, and it's not going to be a thriller like the colorful eruption that occurred in the spring of 2023. That's because the region has received just 0.4 an inch of rain since October, with 0.2 inch of that amount falling in March. Without consistent rainfall, the vibrant displays many hope for will be limited. A true superbloom, a rare event where abundant fall and winter rains trigger an explosion of spring wildflowers, won't happen this year. Annual flowers like Mexican gold poppies and lupines, which rely on deep soaking, will be sparse. However, hardier perennial species like brittlebush and gold mallow are already popping up in yards and along roadsides in Metro Phoenix. Here's when to see or where to see wildflowers in Arizona this spring. In Metro Phoenix and throughout central Arizona, the desert typically blooms from late February to April. Flowers usually peak in March in the lower elevations and all through summer across the Mogollon Rim and mountainous areas in northern Arizona. Will there be a super bloom in 2025? Unfortunately, no. There won't be a super bloom in 2025. Desert annuals depend not only on the amount of rain, but the timing of that rain, says Elizabeth Makings, collections manager at the Arizona State University Herbarium. In my experience, a couple good soaks in the early winter are important for a winter bloom. If you look at the Maricopa County rainfall gauges, for example, in South Mountain, my neighborhood, we have received only 0.8 of an inch of rain since October. no measurable rain for 5 months. That makes for a very poor wildflower season. The rain in March came too late to encourage annual wildflowers like poppies to germinate, but Bakey said that rainfall is enough to allow others, more drought-adapted species, to flower. Plants are responding to rainfall, but the timing and amount is critical too. The last really wet year was 1993, where we had over 13 inches of rain, but if you consider more recently, the years where we had really good wildflowers, we have not come close to that total, Making said. For example, people might remember 2018 as a super bloom, and we had about 9 inches of rain that year. But again, you have to consider seasonality. What sort of a monsoon did we have the previous year? How much rainfall in the previous winter? How much fell in the calendar year before the bloom? And what were the temperatures? Are wildflowers blooming in Arizona? Yes, wildflowers are blooming in central Arizona right now. Brittlebush, Tuberosa, and Globe Mallow are among the species that tend to bloom every year, even in drier conditions. Other wildflowers that tend to bloom reliably include Desert Marigold, bright yellow flowers that thrive in dry conditions. Globe Mallow, orange, pink, or red blooms that can appear nearly year-round. Fairy Duster, pink feathery flowers that bloom in spring and sometimes again in fall. Creosote produces small yellow flowers and a strong desert scent after rain. Ocotillo, red tubular flowers, bloom even after small amounts of rain. Desert Zinnia, small white flowers that can bloom multiple times in a year. So what month is best for wildflowers? Making said central Arizona wildflower peaks in March. Where are the best wildflowers in Arizona right now? For the chance to, or best chance to see blooms, Makings recommends visiting riparian areas with lingering water, such as the Salt River, or look for a destination that has irrigation. If you really want your fix, go to a garden or campus that irrigates. ASU has some beautiful displays of some of our regional cultivated flora. Orchid trees are going crazy right now, desert trumpets, said Makings. The Desert Botanical Garden in Phoenix and Boyce Thompson Arboretum near Superior also irrigate and have reliable displays. Picacho Peak State Park. Most years, Picacho Peak State Park can be counted on for a profusion of wildflowers. This year, the park's website advises people to manage their expectations. Due to dry winter conditions, we don't expect to see many wildflowers this year. Please check back next year. Still, Picacho Peak is a lovely destination for a hike. If blooms do appear, here's where to look for them. Hunter Trail. This popular and challenging trail offers great views of the surrounding desert. Lower portions of the trail often have flowers when there's enough rain. Sunset Vista Trail, a longer, moderate hike that gradually ascends the park's western side. This trail also often has flowers along its lower sections. Callaway Trail, a short and easier hike leading to a scenic overlook where you may find some scattered blooms. And here are the details. Picacho Peak State Park, located at 15520 Picacho Peak Road in Picacho, $10 per vehicle. Call 520-466-3183 if you'd like to know more, or visit the web and go to azstateparks.com. Lost Dutchman State Park. Lost Dutchman State Park, at the base of the Superstition Mountains in Apache Junction, is another favorite spot to look for wildflowers, particularly in the lower elevations and open desert areas. However, as at Picacho Peak, a so-so bloom is likely. This year is not a good wildflower year for us. It was too dry during the winter months, and we aren't really seeing any blooms in the park, said Michelle Thompson, Deputy Assistant Director for Arizona State Parks and Trails. At Lost Dutchman, there may be some brittlebush, but not much else. Both Lost Dutchman and Picacho Peak are still having great weather for hiking, though. If you want to take a spin through Lost Dutchman State Park, try the Treasure Loop Trail, which offers scenic vistas with cactus and other desert plants, the Jacob's Crosscut Trail, which runs along the base of the Superstitions, and the Prospector's View Trail, a short but rewarding hike. Here are the details for Lost Dutchman State Park, located at 6109 North Apache Trail in Apache Junction. Cost is $10 per vehicle, and if you'd like to know more, call 480-982-4485 or visit the web and go to azstateparks.com. Now, here are the best wildflower hikes in Phoenix. According to Arizona Republic contributor Roger Naylor's top 10 wildflower hikes, be sure to watch out for rattlesnakes. Gojon Trail, Cave Creek Regional Park. Scenic Trail, McDowell Mountain Regional Park. Gowanus Trail, South Mountain Park. Marcus Landslide Trail, McDowell Sonoran Preserve. Waterfall Trail, White Tank Mountain Regional Park. Merkel Trail, Usery Mountain Regional Park. Ranger Trail, South Mountain Park. Rainbow Valley, Estrella Mountain Regional Park. And Spur Cross Trail, Spur Cross Ranch Conservation Area. And those of you who are regular listeners to this show know that we feature stories each week from the terrific book called Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. And this book is one of many in the Chicken Soup series, this one devoted entirely to the subject of gardening. And it's comprised of story submissions from authors all over the globe, including some New York Times best-selling authors. This one is called The Rose Babies. It was written by Georgia A. Hubley. And there's a quote here from Hedda Behar. The fragrance always remains in the hand that gives the rose. The Rose Babies. Most people press a flower in a book when they wish to keep it as a memento. My mother doesn't believe in preserving a memory by hiding it. Her motto is, don't press it. When will you look at it again, tucked away in a book? Make it grow. Enjoy its beauty as a living flower, not as a withered keepsake. Ask my mother, she can make anything grow. Recently, Mom received a mixed bouquet of flowers from her sister for her birthday. She is especially fond of roses and was delighted to find two roses in the bouquet. Oh, look at the lovely roses. I've never seen such a beautiful shade of peach in a rose. I must save it as a souvenir. I've seen this process many times, but I watch in awe each time. She takes one of the roses and cuts the bottom at an angle with a pair of scissors, wraps the bottom in a dampened paper towel, and places a rose in a plastic bag to keep it moist. Now I know it's my turn. The magic is about to begin. I run to the pantry to get a quart jar, once used for canning peaches. Here's the enchanted glass jar, I announce as I return with it. We head for her lilac bush. I carry the jar and the plastic bag that contains the rose. She carries warm water in an old coffee can, bent so that it has a spout on each side of it. My mother deliberately keeps her lilac bush overgrown. She trims it in such a way that it becomes fat and dense. The soil beneath it is damp and warm. She easily digs a hole with her hands and places the rose cutting in the hole. I help her carefully pack the dirt around the rose. She places the glass jar over the rose and firmly twists it into the ground. And finally, she gives the rose a drink, pointing the spout of the coffee can to the bottom of the glass jar. She whispers, "Oh, little rose, let me warm your toes. This'll keep you safe when the cold wind blows. See you in the spring, little rose." Little Rose is all ready for her long winter's nap, she explains to me as we walk back to the house. My mother is shameless when it comes to asking for a rose from someone's front yard or their garden, but no one ever refuses her request, and one time the giver was especially glad she had shared her bounty. It was a lovely summer day. My mother and I were walking past our neighbor Dorothy working in her garden. My mother stopped to admire one of Dorothy's roses. I've never seen such a beautiful lavender rose blending into silver at the edge of the petals. Would you mind if I chose one to enjoy? She asked Dorothy. Proud of her special lavender rose bush, Dorothy was delighted to cut the rose and graciously hand it to my mother. But the lavender rose did not go into a vase, as Dorothy probably assumed. It joined the others under the lilac bush, protected under its very own glass jar. That Christmas, Dorothy told us that the beautiful lavender rose bush had been stricken by disease in the fall, and it couldn't be saved. It was my favorite, she said sadly. and I haven't been able to find another to replace it. Spring was delayed that year, but finally the fear of frost was gone. My mother was eager to uncover her rose cuttings, each protected under its miniature greenhouse. I wonder how many of my rose babies will be able to begin their new lives, she mused. As always, I watched in amazement as my mother uncovered her rose babies. Carefully, she twisted the first glass jar from the warm earth. It was a lavender rose clipping. Would that beautiful rose be reborn? She spied a baby shoot, a tiny leaf peeking its way through the stem. Indeed, the lavender rose was alive. Mom whispered to me, "Wait until late summer, and I'll have a surprise for Dorothy. I'll nourish our baby, and it'll thrive into a beautiful bush. She'll then have her lavender rose bush again. It'll be our secret until then." And sure enough, late that summer, Dorothy cried for joy as she received her surprise, a healthy new lavender rosebush. On the card was the following: "Here's a small gift from my garden to you. It began the day someone gave me a rose, too. I planted that rose in the good warm earth, and I nurtured it, hence its happy rebirth." After you've planted this gift and it grows, to keep up the cycle, may I impose? If I may be bold, do you suppose that I might request its very first rose? That's called The Rose Babies, written by George A. Hubley, one of the many stories that make up chicken soup for the gardener's soul. And that's the Green Thumb Show for this week. For Sun Sounds Radio, I'm Lee Murray, your reader. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. Be safe and healthy. And we'll be talking with you soon.